Award-winning journalists. New York Times bestsellers. No topic out of bounds. No opinions left unsaid. An institution for sports talk and information. This is The Sports Reporters. Here's Mike Lupica, Mitch Albom, and Bob Ryan.
I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I am Mike Lupica of the New York Daily News and MLB.com, and welcome to the latest edition of the Sports Reporters podcast, which is something that Bob and Mitch and I are happy to do because we just love having the band be back together after all the years. We did this on Sunday mornings at ESPN. Okay, there's a lot going on in sports. We're about to begin the traditional second half of the baseball season. The commissioner of the NBA had some interesting things to say about how free agency rolled out this time. But this is one of the rare occasions when we will start with tennis. And one of the podcasts next week, we're going to start with the British Open and maybe two of them. But we all of us who do this for a living, we live for the great moment in sports. And we get one tomorrow at Center Court Wimbledon when Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer will play the first match they have played against each other there in 11 years. It's almost impossible to believe that they have not played there since a match that many people call the greatest of all time in the 2008 final. I'll still weigh in on Borg and McEnroe. And I was saying to Mitch and Bob before this, and I'll throw this to Mitch. Mitch, this is such a complicated rivalry, okay? A, because it's lopsided because of the clay court numbers, 25-14 for Nadal. All right, but 14-2 on clay courts. They have never played a match against each other at the U.S. Open. They've only played three times at the Australian Open, and now they rejoin their rivalry at Wimbledon tomorrow, the second semifinal of the day, and I can't wait.
Well, it's all that you just said. It's 24-15. Nadal has the edge, 10-3 in the slams. But as you say, it's weighted. If you really dive into it, if you take the clay out of it, it's a different story. We are now talking about Wimbledon, and what astounds me is that this is the first time in 11 years that these two guys are meeting. How is it possible that with the seedings and how good these guys have been always near, they're always going to be seeded essentially somewhere in the top three unless, you know, they've been out for a while. How they didn't end up meeting in semifinals or quarterfinals or finals before at Wimbledon is just astonishing to me. What also is astonishing is that, and I saw someone ask this question, is this some kind of reflection on a lack of young talent being able to challenge these three guys, none of whom are kids anymore? And the answer was no, at least from the experts that I have read and listened to. There's plenty of good young talent out there. These guys are just still at their ages, able to turn it on when they have to in the big moments and get to these finals, which I think that's the most astounding thing of all. We live in a world where every time we look, there's an 18-year-old or 19-year-old doing something in sports that just astounds us and leapfrogs them in with, you know, maybe even past some of the older guys. Not so in men's tennis.
You mean like a 15-year-old young lady that vaulted
well,
into our consciousness within the last 2 weeks?
Mitch, Zion Williamson.
I think it's interesting that in the way I have read it is that these guys, these two, and that throw in those two particularly, have expressed wonderment, however, that it's still the three of us dominating the way we do, in fact. And I think they are surprised that they haven't been better challenged over the years by more good younger players and what we would call the next generation of players. There's a 4-year age difference between the two of them. It's not like they are exact contemporaries, but Federer's 37 and
going to be 38 next month, by the way.
Yeah, all right, and almost 5-year difference, or 4.5, and 33 for Nadal. Also, each of them are pleasantly surprised to find themselves, just forget about the rivalry thing, just in the vacuum of still being competitive due to the various things that they've battled physically over the years. I think we're not anywhere near the tennis sage that Michael is. I'm more aware of Nadal's physical foibles over the years than I am of the specifics of Federer's, but I know he's battled stuff.
Let me ask our resident expert there. 38, or about to be 38, 33, 32. That's the ages of these three guys. Who's number four, Mike? Who's number four in this group? Where's the 23-year-old male sensation?
I thought Dominic Thiem was set up to be that. You know, he's made two French Open finals against Nadal. He's a gifted kid. And then he flamed out early. Zverev is a nutcase. Kyrgios is more of a nutcase. And so, no, that next level, it's so funny. McEnroe and the Greek kid Tsitsipas is going to be great, okay? But he's not there yet. And when Tsitsipas beat Federer at the Australian Open, McEnroe's on the court afterwards saying the torch has been passed. And I'm thinking, no, it hasn't. Yeah. No, it hasn't. He just won a match. And here we are with the usual suspects. And the historical possibilities of this weekend are tremendous, Mitch and Bob. Okay, ready? Here we go. If Djokovic wins, and he gets the easy, he's got Batista Agut in the semis, he goes to 16 majors. Nadal stays at 18. Federer stays at 20. If Federer wins, he goes to 21. And I'm not even sure that Nadal can catch him. But if Nadal wins this Wimbledon, it's 20-19 going to the U.S. Open. And what's fascinating, even as we continue to call Federer and Nadal the greatest rivalry, Djokovic has a winning record lifetime against both of them. And that's why Djokovic, in his mind, is thinking, hey, boys, not so fast on the GOAT conversation. Yeah. I'm only 32 years old. And by the way, if you look at the three of them, he's had the easiest path so far, Mitch. But he's played the best and looks like half man, half robot when he's at his best.
Well, Bob, what do you think it is about tennis so different from other sports that enables you to excel in your 30s, even in your late, look at Serena in late 30s, and look at Federer late 30s.
And Mitch, let me just interrupt you, because six out of the eight semifinalists this year at Wimbledon on both sides, men's and women's, are over the age of 30. All four men's semifinalists are over the age of 30 in what we've always thought of as a kid's sport.
Mike, I'm going to tap your history gene here with this one, okay? Now, the one name that springs to my mind in my early acquaintance with the sport that became noted for his longevity was Rose Wall.
Yeah.
And who was in his late 30s.
When I
30s,
went to my
right?
first Wimbledon, Bob, he was 39 playing 21-year-old Jimmy Connors.
Other than that, Mike, in those days, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, was there anybody that lingered fairly long into their 30s other than him? Or was he an outlier? And if that's the case, I'm going to try to – my supposition on this question would be – better conditioning, better just the modern better conditioning at methodologies and nutrition and awareness of stuff and medical advances and all account for the ability of more guys to play bet longer in their 30s than 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, and these guys just may be freakish, okay, in their own conditioning and talent. And Mitch and I think we talked about this one day when you weren't here, Bob. But no, the only other notable exception, and it was an outlier, was when Jimmy Connors, in a great tennis moment, made it to the semifinals of the 91 U.S. Open at the age of 39, out of nowhere, unseeded. And Mitch, the day we talked about this, I told you that Connors and Chris and Martina said they weren't as obsessed with majors in their day. Like, they didn't want to go to schlep to Australia in December, okay? Mm. And Connors and Chris have told me the same thing. Hey, we were just interested in winning tournaments. We're looking for a couple of paragraphs in the sports section. So I came, Mitch and Bob, you know this. I came to this sport, my hand being held by Bud Collins in the 1970s. I walked into Connors, Borg, McEnroe. And you guys have ad infinitum heard me say this. They won 26 major championships among them. Okay. If Djokovic, Nadal, or Federer wins this Wimbledon, they will have a total of 54 right. among them. Okay.
Well,
nothing like this has ever happened in the sport, will ever happen in the sport.
But when I look at the names of the youngest Grand Slam winners There's something that jumps out. Tracy Austin, 16. Maria Sharapova, 17. Michael Chang, 17. Boris Becker, 17. Mats Wilander, 17. Bjorn Borg, 18. But they're all of an era, with the exception of Sharapova, who's more modern. They're all of a different time. This didn't happen 4 years ago, 3 years ago. I wonder if, and this is just supposition on my part, I wonder if there's a change in who's going into tennis young these days, who wants to give of themselves the way that these kids who used to, you know, ship themselves, or well, their parents did when they were 8 years old, to Bollettieri's Academy and places like that, and that was the end of your life. You just only played tennis as a kid, and that was it. I wonder if that young physical talent isn't being siphoned off into other areas.
I think in other countries it still happened. And I think kids from across the world still come to Florida to go to IMG, to go to those places, Mitch. In our country, you know, we talked about this the other day. It's just mind-boggling that we haven't had a major American men's champion since Andy Roddick. Okay?
Yeah. And nobody on the horizon.
And nobody's really sniffed one since. Fortunately, we've had the Williams sisters on the other side of the sport, and Serena's going to be going for her 24th major on Saturday in the women's final against Halep. No, Mitch, it's a fascinating conversation. But there's two conversations. It's just crazy that these three guys came along at the same time. Okay. And by the way, in this time, there have been a couple other guys who have won three major championships. Andy Murray did before he got hurt, and Stan Wawrinka kind of snuck in and won three. But what we are getting here in this sport is like if Connors, Borg, and McEnroe had lasted longer. Pete Sampras, who retired with 14 majors. Okay. He quit when he was 31 years old. I saw him win his last Open against Andre Agassi. He just didn't want to keep playing. These guys want to keep playing forever.
Two questions for me. You are a resident tennisologist. One is. How talented is Kyrgios? How much of a squandering is taking place with this guy getting in, interfering with himself?
He's the modern Nastasi, and even Illy, my old friend, won way more and won major championships than this guy. He is, if you, Mitch, I don't know if you watched any of Nadal Kyrgios in the second round, okay? It was tennis played at such a high level. And when the kid cuts the shit, he's wonderful to watch, but he's one of those guys. Mitch, you have seen this kind of guy in all other sports. He sabotages himself. I think there's some deep rooted fear of failure that he acts out the way he does. But Bob, in terms of talent, he's as talented as anybody out there.
Right. But you've answered a little bit our questions here, because if you look at Nadal, Federer, particularly Federer and Djokovic, these guys are as steady mentally as they come.
Oh, yeah.
They do not have that gene that says, you know, I'm just going to, my flame is going to go higher. It doesn't exist sometimes to the point that you call them robotic. You know, Nadal has a little bit, plays with a little bit more passion, but as he's gotten older, he's gotten kind of more that way too. And I think one of the other answers about this is that unlike other sports, the mental element of big points, you can get better at as you get older, and it can overcome some of your physical, shrinkage as you get older. Whereas kids with a load of talent and 140 mile an hour serve may not just be up to that big point. It's just you and that ball and that racket when you have to win that point. And apparently guys like Federer and Djokovic, they just don't choke. And that may be some of it too.
And Mitch, here's the thing about these guys. We thought we had kind of lost all of this. Djokovic had some personal problems and had an elbow issue. Okay. Federer and Nadal, before they showed up at the Australian Open final a few years ago, they had fallen out of things. Nobody was ever sure if they would play at a high level ever again. So what, in addition to everything you just said, Mitch, they have shown the ability and the mental toughness and the athletic character to come back from stuff, to put in the time, because this stuff matters. And think about this, okay, on both sides, because the Serena story is as compelling on her side of the sport as the guys are on theirs. we could have two 37-year-old Wimbledon champions this weekend. Yeah. One winning his 21st, the other winning her 24th. I mean, again, I tell people all the time, if you, even if you're just a casual fan of tennis, but a sports fan, you got to appreciate what is happening in this sport right now, because again, nothing close to this will ever happen again.
Do they still do that banquet thing on Sunday night where they have the male champion dance? So they're going to have to play an oldie. For them, if they're going to do it, if it's going to be Serena and Federer, they got to play something from the 80s or 90s.
Now, Mitch, let me ask you this. Bob and Mitch, let me ask you this. Okay. Mitch, who are you rooting for tomorrow? Federer and Nadal?
Federer. I just feel, I always root for the guy that I think I'm going to see the least of anymore. You know, Nadal, especially the way he's been playing, he looks like he's got more gas in his tank. I keep waiting for Federer to make the announcement, like, okay, that's enough, and bye, you know, because he doesn't say a whole lot. So clearly Federer for me.
All right, this ties in, my answer, and this ties in with my second question, Mike, so it's a perfect segue, Mitch. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, thank you.
But you know what they say about great minds. Now, which is this, I'm going to root for Federer, not against Nadal, but I'm going to root for Federer, but I have a second question. But it tied in with that is this, Michael. Within the tennis community, within the tennis sages, is there a remote, but attached to the proliferation of majors accumulated by Mr. Nadal due to the French Open thing?
A little bit.
The French Open, it skews the
It skews the conversation, absolutely. And I you know, it's just that he could win 12 of those, knowing what a grind it is to be at Roland Garros on those slow courts through the weather and everything else. Yes, it skews the conversation. Before we leave this whole tennis thing, and again, this might be as long as we'll ever talk about tennis on this podcast, I will just say this. Roger Federer may be the greatest combination of grace and talent as I've ever covered. And you think of the career he's had on the public stage, okay? The joy he still brings to this, the lack of scandal, the lack of controversy. He's had the career that Tiger Woods wishes he's had, health-wise, talent-wise, grace-wise in golf.
All right. Well said. Hey, before we move on, I just want to tell you about Geico. Okay, this is a 30-second commercial, and I'm going to throw a lot of numbers at you, but please stay with me. In just 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. This company has been offering great rates and great service for over 75 years. And anytime you need help, you can speak to one of their trained specialists 24/7. The company is Geico. Go to geico.com today. Sorry for all the numbers. And in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm out of time.
Let's shift over to the baseball world now that we've started the second half of the season. All-Star game, all finished, done. The accusations of juiced balls and it's hard to say juiced balls without, you know, it's just on a podcast without going on.
You mean the new steroids era, Mitch?
Yeah. But the accusation made by Justin Verlander, denied by Commissioner Manfred. I don't know. One way or another, we're going to end up with a whole lot of home runs by the time this second half is over. But what are some of the big things we're looking for in the second half of this season?
Well, I mean, the when one race is over. We know that the National League West is over. I'm looking at what would happen. I have to be parochial. You know, the Red Sox are very inconsistent, maddeningly infuriating team this year. Can they put it together to not to catch the Yankees, but to be?
Is it maddeningly and infuriating? A bit
yeah, I know. And I'm reading this wonderful book by Mr. Dreyer about the grammar and the punctuation, and so I'm tying myself up in. But anyway, how good can the Red Sox be? I'm going to throw this one out. There's two things going on here that are contradictory. One is we know that we have teams on pace to win 100, and we have a disgusting number of teams on pace to lose 100, and that's not a good thing. And that's the whole philosophical conversation about how teams are arranging themselves and everything else. But I'm going to throw this one out. In fact, in the National League right now, though two races are over, one, I'm giving Atlanta the East with a 6-game lead.
It's
not over, over,
Nats
but
out.
The other one is over. 13.5 game lead for the Dodgers, okay? There are 8 teams in the National League between 42 and 45 losses right now. Yeah. Washington, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Arizona, San Diego, and Colorado. There's a ninth team with 46 losses. So we have nine teams within four losses of each other, which means that in theory, we're going to have a very competitive, you know, at a certain mediocre level perhaps, but competitive September for playoff spots such as they are. That it, I guess that's a good thing, right?
I mean, I wouldn't count the Washington Nationals out in the National League East as gifted as the Braves are. Mitch, have you been following what they were doing? I think they were 18-29 at one point. Were they going to trade Scherzer? Were they going to trade this guy? Were they going to put this guy on the market? Yeah. They have had a remarkable turnaround. And I know this is hurtful to say to you, Mitch, much of it led by... named Max Scherzer, okay, who has picked himself up, dusted himself off of a rather sketchy start for him. So, Bob, I'm not writing them off, okay? The Central's going to be fascinating because anybody, including the Reds, might be able to win.
Out of it. As I said, the Reds are not out of it. And they're hovering. They're only two games out in the loss in the division.
And in the American League right now, I said this the other day, and I believe it. And Mitch, you're a Central guy, okay? I am not counting the Cleveland Indians out of anything. The Twins are going to have to prove to me that they can stand up to the rigors and the responsibilities of a pennant race over the rest of the season.
Keep looking at the Twins and saying, how are they doing it? You know,
home runs.
With a whole lot of offense, a new manager, a lot of guys you never heard of, and they're on pace to win over 100 games. Now, I think just as quickly as this thing sort of rose from the ashes, it can also sink. I mean, that famous line from Bull Durham, it's a long season and you got to trust it, always plays in my mind when I talk about baseball. And particularly when teams are surprising. At the end of a season, you get one surprise team that holds up as a surprise, and then it's a lot of usual suspects. And Minnesota might be that team by the end of the season, but we expected Cleveland to be good. We didn't expect Minnesota to be this good. And Minnesota slipped a little bit lately. I wouldn't be surprised if Cleveland ultimately ends up winning this thing. It'll be interesting if Minnesota ends up being a wild card chase and them or a Tampa Bay or a Boston, you know, are fighting for that last spot. But we'll see if they hold up. But again, usual suspects, Yankees, Houston,
Dodgers.
I'm talking about American League. Obviously the Dodgers and the Cubs and things like that. And I think that's what you don't you agree that that's how it kind of ends up? Usual suspects plus one mystery guest to the dance.
Yeah, and I'm never surprised that the A's are in it. Never, never, never. I was talking to Brian Cashman on the Mike Lubega podcast today, and I said, no matter what the A's record is in May, I always expect them to win 15 out of 20. And get, so they are where they are. I think the Texas Rangers, Mitch, have been a huge surprise as serious wild card contender because I don't know what the expectations were for the Rangers this year. So your wild card possibilities right now. Okay, let's say that the Indians don't come back. Are Cleveland, Tampa Bay, Boston, the Oakland A's, the Texas Rangers, and I keep hoping that the Angels are so star-crossed that this looks like it's going to be another October where Mike Trout doesn't get the stage. But right now, the wild card races are look more interesting in the American League than the divisional races.
Yeah.
I just want to jump back 1 second back to the discussion of the Nationals, which is this. If, in fact, the Nationals do have a upward trend here and get themselves involved in it, this would be a vindication for a very beleaguered manager. Would you not agree that...
Dave Martinez, all of the managers who were supposed to be first fired were in the National League East, Bob. Martinez, Gabe Kapler, and Mickey Callaway. And for now, they're all still standing. But Mitch and Bob, let me ask you this. Is there any sort of karmic intervention here that the Nationals right now, without Bryce Harper, are better than the Phillies with Bryce Harper?
And they're playing each other.
The one thing that comes to mind, of course, are the two career juxtapositions of A-Rod, when teams got better after he left. And that just jumps into mind. But right now, the Phillies I mean, excuse me, the Nationals don't look so bad.
Isn't that why they used to call A-Rod the cooler? Wasn't he one of the guys that they called the cooler in baseball?
I mean, one of the greatest things in history is the fact that the 0-1 Mariners won 116 games. Without
but it also happened to Peyton Manning. Remember, he left Tennessee, and then T. Martin was the quarterback when they won the national championship.
Just got to throw something out. We weren't going to talk about the All-Star game, I'm sure, but I want to.
Parting shot on how much I like the All-Star game.
The home run derby was, which I don't originally like or care about. I did get hooked on because of the kid, and everybody's going to remember. It's one of those things, you know. Alonso won, but the guy that people are going to remember is Vladdy Jr. But I want to say this: Alonso is refreshing. What is there not to like about Pete Alonso?
Did he not say all the right things? Bob and Mitch, but Mitch, I don't know if you know this, but Pete Alonso was not guaranteed a spot on this roster because they were going to do that thing and hold him back at the start of the year because of that whole, you know, when you lose control of him down the road, okay? This kid showed up. He hit a ball at JetBlue Park in Fort Myers against the Red Sox, and they all said, holy crap, who's that, okay? Mm. And he has continued to do that, and then afterwards, the other night, did he not say ever? Did he hit a bad note, Bob? He didn't hit a single bad note. Like, he didn't have many bad swings. No, he's what we have to watch at Citi Field, along with that dirty uniform, Jeff McNeil at the top of the uniform, who's an old-fashioned spray the ball around guy.
Hey, by the way, before we leave baseball, a word about Jim Boughton, who passed away.
Yes, oh, man.
I got to know him briefly when he came to our university, when I was at Brandeis University, to speak. I don't know where he was at that point, at post-baseball. It was in the late 70s. But, my friend ran the speakers bureau, and so we had to pick him up at the airport and bring him over, you know, the way you do in college, and bring him to, you know, basically they come to your dorm room and hang out until they do their speech. And so we got to spend some time with him. And so I've always sort of had a little bit of a fondness, although he wasn't a great guy, I got to say. He wasn't the most pleasant individual. But that book and that view, Ball 4, we're talking about to all our younger listeners, and if you've never read it, it's worth it just from a historical point of view, published in 1970, still remains singular. In a world where everything has been done again and remade again and over again, and even he tried to remake his own book multiple times, no one has ever given a look inside baseball. What it's really like inside a locker room, the fears, the craziness, the shenanigans and the wrongdoing even, like that book did. And to still be saying that in a world where everything is exposed, these days, to still be saying that, you know, almost 50 years later is pretty amazing.
One of the best and most important sports books ever written. I got, when I tweeted out, cause I knew Jim, I knew him mostly after his playing career because he was a terrific nightly sportscaster. Smart, funny, just as you'd expect in New York City, okay? And somebody sent me a tweet last night that said, that book and Jerry Kramer's with our dear friend Dick Schaap changed everything I thought about sports heroes, okay? And Instant Replay and Ball 4 were seminal moments in the world of sports and sports publishing. And Mitch and Bob, I don't know if you remember this, Boughton made this comeback as a knuckleball pitcher.
I certainly do remember.
And had this kind of fun second act long after his baseball career was supposed to be over.
I certainly do remember that. And it was very fascinating. No, that book, that book stands the test of time in that regard, and you know, made him so persona. The fallout was hilarious to step back and look at it. You know, the commissioner just foaming at the mouth. You know, the buoy, and the Yankee reaction. Of course, you know, with the exposing of the Mick. Just infuriated the Mickey Mantle worshippers, you know,
and everybody else. There was somebody told the story last night that Pete Rose from the dugout one.
Oh yeah,
F.U. Shakespeare. Okay, and but there's so Mitch. I don't know how well you remember the book. Oh my God! First of all, it had Joe Schultz coming up with one of the great words of all time.
Buds.
Shit, fuck, yeah, okay. And the other thing was, and I'm paraphrasing the line, but it was the funniest line in the book. Was one of the players saying, the most difficult thing about being a big league ball player was explaining to your wife why she had to take penicillin for your kidney infection.
All right. You can't shift off a better note than that. Last thing we want to discuss before we get to our parting shots. The NBA was not headlined for the last few days.
What?
Because, yes, everybody has found a new team except perhaps Russell Westbrook.
Except for Megan Rapinoe. Everybody except her has found a new team.
But Commissioner Adam Silver spoke about the fact that he's concerned about the way free agency went down this year on several points. Number one, that free agency was supposed to start at 6 o'clock on a Sunday, and by 5:30 on that same Sunday, everybody knew where everybody was going, and they all but had picked out their new cars, and that's not supposed to happen. And secondly, the trade demands by guys like Anthony Davis, and then basically Paul George going to his team after signing a 4-year deal, and after 1 year of it saying, you know what, I just got a phone call from my buddy Kawhi Leonard, I want to go play in LA, make a deal. And the way that OKC acquiesced on that is not good for the future of the sport. I agree with him on both points. And I don't know what he can do, and I'm curious about your guys' thoughts about what can you do for tampering, because the truth is most of the tampering now goes on between players.
That's
not
right.
Between players and owners.
I don't know how you legislate it, Mitch. How's he going to legislate that? I don't know. I agree with everything you just said. And we talked about this the other day, Mitch and Bob. Ultimately, for all of the headlines and all of the sound and fury and hype, I still don't think this is good for business. And let me just throw this to Bob for a second, Mitch, okay? Everything they've tried to do with free agency was to protect smaller markets, and now they're defenseless.
Yeah, they are. That disturbs me greatly, because one of the beauties I thought over the course of time in the last three decades of the NBA, as it was in the NFL with the Green Bay being able to compete, is that you could compete in a Portland, you could compete in a Memphis, you could compete in an OKC, become one of the wonderful, nice stories of our time was the reception that the NBA has gotten in Oklahoma City. And now they've seen the team stripped, you know, one after the other, and Harden, all right, that was and Durant, and if West, and
they did everything except move them back to Seattle.
Yeah, you know, and that's not good, you know, and I don't like that. And you're right. Well, what do you do when the source of the players? I don't know.
I'll throw this to Mitch Albom. Okay, Mitch, what do you do? You love basketball, Detroit, because especially because of the Bad Boys and a completely wonderful championship that they won with Joe Dumars in charge and Larry Brown coaching. They have a proud basketball history in Detroit. Mitch, you're stuck in the worst place there is in the NBA. You're stuck in the middle, and unless you consider Blake Griffin still a superstar, okay, you got nobody that people are actually paying big ticket money to watch. So what the hell do you do? And what are Detroit basketball fans thinking as they watch all of this musical chairs? And not only do they not have a chair, they're standing over on the side watching it all.
Well, don't think that doesn't concern Tom Gore as the owners of the Pistons and the other players.
Who's a good owner, by the way? Who's a good owner?
He's willing to put the money up, but I mean, if you're in a city where nobody wants to go, and increasingly every NBA player now is looking at their post career, you know, from Kevin Durant to LeBron James to, you know, I've got to be in New York or LA to set myself up in my media production business and my TV production business and all the rest. Well, I'm sorry, you can't do that in Detroit. You can't do that in Phoenix. You can't do that in Oklahoma City. They're just, you know, every town isn't Hollywood. And if players are basically going to manipulate, especially the best players, manipulate their way to those cities, it reminds me a lot of what's happened in the soccer world internationally. If you follow that, it's the same kind of thing. Nobody expects any player to stay for more than a couple of years. They all go where the biggest money is. They jump countries and leagues as fast as possible. And the sense of loyalty is dissipated. And I, you know, Silver's got to be privately pulling what few hairs he has left off of his head, because this is not
eyebrow plucking at this point, frankly.
Range good for the sport. It is not. You know, I understand there. It's very in vogue right now for media types who want to be pals with the players to say, hey, the players are the game. Players are the game. Players are the game. It's all about the players of the game. Well, so are the franchises the game, and so are the cities the game. And by the way, the owners are not extraneous to the process. It's gotten to the point where owners are like useless. Why are we even talking about an owner? Well, they do put up the money. They do take the risk. They do buy the franchise, and they do are responsible for that franchise after that player has decided to go waltz off to some more attractive city. And I think a league that is tilted strictly to where the players' whims are and where they want to go is not long-range good for fandom, because it just becomes a cult of personality at that point. It's not sports. It's who can I follow my star favorite player? We don't have guys like that here, and there are a lot of other cities in the country that are saying the same thing.
No, but Mitch, this to me, and I could be dead wrong about this, and Bob knows. You know, when I got to New York, I covered the New York Knicks, okay? I was about 12 years old, and my introduction to big-time sports writing was covering the New York Knicks. I love basketball, okay? I just feel that this is like a dot-com bubble about to burst. I'm not saying the sport's going to go south. It's still going to be star-driven and all that. But you tell me in February, okay, if one of those teams isn't playing, why are you watching the NBA on television?
Right. Right. Or going out to pay for a ticket in your town.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right.
But, Bob, you know that they set all these rules in place to protect that everybody was – the Bird rules, the Bird – all that stuff, okay? Where are those rights now?
Yeah. What is the one irrefutable and immutable reality of that sums all this up is that there is always a law of unintended consequence in play.
Yeah.
And we did not see that this would evolve in this way because we never – thought that there were these coalitions of powerful players where they weren't even a concept when this was. Well, the first free agency, it was 1988, and it was famously done by the Suns, who knocked on Tom Chambers' door at 1:12:01 after midnight and made him the first free agent signee. And we never knew it would come to
hey, but
where
Mitch,
it was.
Meanwhile,
Mitch,
we've now.
Let me ask you this, Mitch, because it's a Detroit question, okay? And the Raptors were a little like this, except they had a superstar in Kawhi. When's the next time we're going to see a team like the 04 Pistons who do it and win a championship against a star Laker team without one of those guys on the team? Is that possible now?
I don't know if that's possible anymore, Mike. I don't know, because the best teams now have three superstars on and not two, or not one and a half. And Joe Dumars put together that team of cast-offs, you know, Rasheed Wallace and Chauncey Billups and Rip Hamilton. These are guys other teams didn't want and somehow molded. They should have won two championships. But I do think that those days are gone. And it's not surprising that Joe Dumars is out of the business too. You know, he saw that kind of writing on the wall too, that unless you're in a particular town, you don't have that power. By the way, to put a cap on this, while we've been talking about all this, quietly Kawhi Leonard decided to sign a 3-year contract, not a 4-year contract, so that he and Paul George would be free agents at exactly the same time, only furthering the grip that they have. All right, let's
and Mitch, by the way, when people forget that those Pistons should have won two in a row, and if Rasheed had stayed home on Ori in game 7, they would have won two in a row.
Yeah. Oh, well. Let's go to our parting shots, and Mike Lupica, why don't you lead us off?
Now, parting shots.
Okay, I'm going to tell you straight up, baseball's All-Star Game is far and away now the best in major sports, and I don't even think it's close. The NBA All-Star Game's a joke, a glorified layup line and lob and dunkathon. The Pro Bowl's unwatchable. But baseball's still different. It actually seems to matter to these young guys. I even like it when they're yucking it up from the field with Joe Buck and John Smoltz. Now, this comes from somebody who remembers what it was like when the baseball All-Star Game was still the All-Star Game, and the only time you could see Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron on the same field. And I am aware that that's a generational thing. I grew up in the time when the Midsummer Classic really did feel like a Midsummer Classic before interleague play. Now, nobody would call what we saw from Cleveland the other night any kind of classic, but it was just pure fun all the way until an ex-Indian named C.C. Sabathia came out for that mound visit with Aroldis Chapman in the ninth, a way of getting C.C. a Cleveland curtain call. There was no great baseball moment the other night during the game. I just thought the whole night was a nice moment for baseball. Classic or not?
You know, my friends here are each successful authors of fiction. I do not have that yet. But would either Mike, Mitch, would you have had the audacity to invent an athlete who in the course of 15 seasons competed for 16 separate championships and was the winner in 14 of them? Of course not. No. That would strain all credulity. It could never happen. But that was the real-life resume of Bill Russell, who was properly labeled by Kobe Bryant and last night's ESPYs as, and I quote, the greatest winner that sports has ever known, unquote. For the record, those aforementioned championships were two NCAA titles, the 1956 Olympic gold medal, and 11 NBA titles in 13 seasons. But that's just the beginning of the Bill Russell story. Bill Russell is a truly great American who was in the forefront of the 50s and 60s civil rights movement and who has always stood for human dignity, regardless of color. But do ponder those numbers I gave you. And as a kicker, digest this. In the course of his career, there were 21 times when someone was going home tonight. Winner take all. That includes all NCAA games, all Olympic medal round games, and both best of fives and best of sevens in the NBA. In those particular 21 games, Bill Russell's teams were 21-0. I doubt that was a coincidence. Kobe, you nailed it.
So today I saw a video of Washington Redskins cornerback Josh Norman running with the Bulls in Pamplona. For a while, it was a top story on ESPN.com. Well, not to throw shade, but I ran with the Bulls 30 years before Norman did. Twice. The first day, just to say I did it. The second day, to take pictures so people would believe me. For those who have never read Hemingway, running with the Bulls is part of Pamplona's Festival of San Ferman, an 8-day-long event. And the running takes place each morning at 8 a.m., but it is not a morning event. It's the last event of a very long, long night in which the main point is to get as drunk as humanly possible. Bourbon Street during the Super Bowl is mild compared to Pamplona before the bull runs. Maybe because only a drunk person would try this. At 7:45, they block off all the side streets so you can't escape. Then at 8 a.m. sharp, they say prayers and shoot off a cannon, and bang, they release the bulls. If you're standing near the start, the bulls run right past you. If you're standing near the end, they pack in with you in the tunnel to the stadium, and that's where you are likely to get gored. And I don't mean Frank Gored. So the ideal spot is about halfway, which is where I started, thanks to a veteran Spanish bull runner who traded me this knowledge in exchange for me introducing him to English-speaking women. As we ran beside the bulls, he took out a rolled-up newspaper and started poking at the bulls' horns, going, yada, 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 which is when I knew I was doing something only a foolish young man should ever try. Well, I survived and came back for a photo the next day. Of course, my photo's not like Norman's video, which shows him leaping over a bull at the stadium. Show off. But then I did it twice. And as I and that stunned bull that he jumped over might say to Norman, let's see you try that again. That's going to wrap it up for today's program. We do this every Monday and Thursday. The Sports Reporters Podcast, available wherever you get popular podcasts. If you enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it, leave us a comment. We always enjoy reading those. And until we see you on Monday, on behalf of Mike Lupica and Bob Ryan, this is Mitch Albom saying have a great weekend.